So the title of this short course is The Lutheran Church in American History. And this was chosen, I guess, especially with the bicentennial in mind this year. And we want to explore some of the facets of Lutheran synods, Lutheran churches, not only the Missouri Synod, but also of some others, within the context of this comparatively young or new nation. And this is quite apropos, I think, especially in this year. And one of the first things I want to do, as you can see from the topics in my major captions here, like colonial explorations, I want to put this into a deeper historical perspective so that we don't come away with the notion that here, this year, our nation is 200 years old, and we simply assume that when America became independent or sometime before, there were Lutherans or even prefab Lutheran churches, as it were, dropped down by parachute that were just there automatically. Not at all. This has a historical development, and I'm going to try to put these pieces together for you so that you can see it in that perspective. Now, the overall topic for the first lecture I call Explorers, Colonists, and Religious Pioneers in America. For lack of anything better, I wanted to get these three notions in here at least. And when we look at the opening of America, you know, if you can picture our own country now before the Europeans came, when this country was occupied by Indians. And of course, you know some of this history already, the story of Columbus and so on. That's where we want to begin. To see, what I'm going to try to show you is that in the Americas, now both South and North America, there was a point in our history when it was just by a hair's breadth, as it were, that America escaped being completely dominated by the Catholic powers from Europe. So when we look at the individual explorers and the nations which staked out the first claims in the New World after Columbus came, we have a strong, dominant Roman Catholic impact. Now, my first little introductory topic, I call attention to the Vikings, but this is only just as a curiosity. There were no permanent settlements which resulted from the Vikings. And I put this in here because the other week when I drew up this outline, I had just read the claim by a Roman Catholic historian that the Vikings were the first Roman Catholics in North America. And if you have heard the story of Eric the Red, who was said to have been on the Atlantic coast, even north from what you can see on this map has a slight spring defect in there, and I can't pull it down further. Eric the Red was said to have been off the Atlantic coast by about the year 1000. And so this is an interesting little vignette of history that some people like to throw in the face of Columbus worshippers, you know, to discomfort them, that some European was there almost 500 years before Christopher Columbus got there. But it's only a passing curiosity for this purpose. And with Columbus coming to the West Indies in 1492 and repeated journeys, laying claim to this area of the New World here for the King of Spain, penetrating the Gulf of Mexico, also Central America, and then South America, by 1500 and soon after, this gave the Spaniards a tremendous, broad, deep, and early claim to this huge landmass that we now call the Americas. And before very long, the Spaniards were looking mostly southward, by the way, at that time. Later on, they gradually penetrated through these areas here, which now comprise the southern tier of our own states. But earlier, they were looking southward and westward. By 1513, you may remember from high school or grade school history, Balboa had crossed the Isthmus of Panama, and so they knew that there was only a narrow landmass blocking their way to the Indies, or the Far East. That's what they called the general landmass that they knew to be out there in Asia, including what is today Indonesia, even the Philippines, China, and India. Southeast Asia was just generally described that way. And what the Spaniards did then was to portage across the isthmus, and they developed ports down further on the coast of South America, and were interested in developing trade across the Pacific. But the Indians that they met from Mexico down into South America, the first thing they did was rob them of their gold. The second thing they did was convert them to Christianity. Now, that was a poor combination, I think. But they were ready to use some force. And this is one of the interesting little sidelights of Indian missions on which we will not dwell very long. But I'm going to try to show you what I said before, the Roman Catholic powers. Now, I haven't got the St. Lawrence Seaway in here, but if you can imagine now, that runs out about like that. And approximately 100 years after the Spanish began to penetrate the Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic coast, Central America and South America, the French developed a foothold in what is today Eastern Canada, in the St. Lawrence Seaway. And so this name, Samuel de Champlain, I'm sure you recognize that name. His name was given to that lake in Upper New York State. He determined to found New France in the New World and set out for this purpose in 1605. And you can see this is more than 100 years after the Spaniards already penetrated into the Western Hemisphere. At that time, the French founded Acadia, which later on was taken over in a war by the English, and they called it New Scotland, and we always use the Latin expression Nova Scotia for that province today in Canada. But that was opened at that time. Then in 1608, the French founded Quebec. Montreal founded 1642. One of the other interesting French explorers was this nobleman called La Salle. We usually skip the preliminaries because it's easier for us. He was a very prominent Frenchman, and he began pushing this idea of a greater France. And he began a program of building forts into the Great Lakes Basin, even down this far here on the coast of Lake Michigan. He had one, and even penetrating down into what is today Illinois, and also the state of Michigan. And then the French began to penetrate all the way down the Mississippi River. They portaged, went through the Great Lakes, and then the Fox River in Wisconsin, and portaged into the Wisconsin River, which was not a very great distance, and then got into the Mississippi, and floated down the Mississippi with their canoes, exploring that whole area. And before long, they were all the way down into the Gulf of Mexico. And then the French also approached this problem of staking out claims to this vast area in which they were interested, from the Atlantic Ocean sailing into the Gulf of Mexico, and they established a fort approximately in here someplace, right about there, for the purpose of making certain that they would have free access to this vast waterway, the Mississippi River. And then before long, they founded New Orleans there in 1718. That's an old French city. And then just in passing, by the way, They also founded a city right here called St. Louis after their king. And then another double C there, this Louis Joliet, or Joliet, he was commissioned by Governor Frontenac, that has to have an R in it, by the way, in 1673 to find the Northwest Passage. And some of this exploratory movement down the Mississippi grows out of this. You see, he pushed westward as far as he could in the Great Lakes Basin, couldn't find a way out to the Pacific. Then they tried the Mississippi River, and they began to be aware of the fact that they were not getting out to the Pacific Ocean at all. But they tried to make the best of what they had found. And so by 1700, or shortly after, it looked as if France from the north and through the center of the North American continent and the Spanish from the Gulf of Mexico and from their bases in Central and South America would just enclose all of the Americas. And they were both very zealous Roman Catholic powers. And both of these nations, the Spanish more so than the French, but both nations made it a primary purpose of their explorations to persuade the indigenous population, Indians all over, from Canada to Peru, to join the Roman Catholic Church. Now, there were, however, some Protestant powers that entered the space between from the Atlantic seaboard, and that's the third point here, which I will develop now. On some of these topics, I won't dwell very long because, like small a, the Danes in the New World, this was just a passing exploration, but this Danish-sponsored exploration also to find the Northwest Passage. They tried to get through this landmass to get to Asia, and they tried the Hudson's Bay, way up north. You know, this map doesn't show it. And they sailed up in there in the year 1619 and got caught in the ice. And all of the crew, they had two ships, all the crew died except three people, but there was a Lutheran chaplain along, and he conducted regular services, Lutheran services. So it is a small but interesting little opening wedge for Lutheran work in North America. But the chaplain, Rasmus Jensen, himself died, so this was only in the winter from 1619 to 1620. That this activity went on. If the captain of the expedition hadn't been able to free the smaller of the vessels in spring from the ice and hurry out of there, we wouldn't even know anything about this. Now, a more lasting penetration of the eastern seaboard came from the Dutch. The Dutch were very zealous and determined explorers and commercial entrepreneurs for all their very small country that they had in Europe. And you remember at this time the Dutch were fighting for their very lives against their Spanish overlords, we might say, because Spain held the lowlands, including both what is today Belgium and Holland, as a colonial province at that time. And especially when the Dutch people had become Protestant in the Reformation era, the Spaniards really put the thumb on them, determined either to convert them back to Roman Catholicism or to wipe them out from the face of the earth. And this was one of the main incentives which made the Dutch really fight for their very lives. And then they knew also that there was a lot of good profit to be made if they could get past the Spaniards, you know, in this outreach to the colonial areas. So they had two very compelling reasons. And at the very time that the Dutch were fighting for their national existence against Spain, which was the mightiest empire in the whole world, At that very time, they engaged in colonial exploration, and they chartered Henry Hudson, who was really not Dutch at all, to sail for them and also to find a northwest passage through the North American landmass. And he came into these passages here, you see, at New York, past Long Island, and then he found this river which ran southward, and he thought that he should explore that, hopefully, that it would lead to some other waterways, that it would eventually take him to the Pacific. Well, he sailed up this river, and because he had discovered it, the river to this day bears his name, and it gave the Dutch a claim to that area. So before very long, there were Dutch citizens, businessmen, explorers, settling in the Hudson Valley, beginning with present-day New York. And you remember the story in 1624, they made a bargain with some Indians on Manhattan and bought that real estate for equivalency of about 24 U.S. dollars. And have you heard the latest? You know, with all the problems New York City has, the other week they tried to sell it back to the Indians for 24 bucks and they wouldn't buy it. Well, this was a significant breakthrough because the Dutch sent over permanent colonists who established the city, what is now the city of New York, on southern Manhattan. And there were also Lutherans. Now, I should say here, I had only mentioned before in general that the Dutch became Protestants in the Reformation, but they became Reformed. That is, they became followers of Calvinist theology, but there were some Dutch who were Lutheran. And some Lutherans also among the Dutch came over into their New Amsterdam colony. And by 1623, that's a date I haven't got on here, but actually you might want to write it in, the first Lutheran group was organized on American soil. And that was a congregation in New York City, what is today New York City. At that time it was called New Amsterdam, as you may know. And by the way, another important Lutheran congregation was organized there in 1648, and that is today the Missouri Synod congregation called St. Matthew's, later on that joined the Missouri Synod. And that's our oldest congregation in the whole Missouri Synod. And that was organized 199 years before the Missouri Synod was founded. Did you catch that one? That congregation was founded in 1648. This earliest one is 1623. And the Missouri Synod was founded in 1847. So that big a time span we have there of the early Atlantic seaboard Lutheranism, and on the other hand, the founding of the Missouri Synod, our own church body now in the Midwest. Well, we'll move along here. Do you know what happened to New Amsterdam afterwards? I won't tell you right here, but I have another section on the changes of real estate in America before the American Revolution. Well, it became English, you know, in a war before very long. Now, we want to take a look at also the upper Hudson Valley. You know, the Dutch sailed up the Hudson River and up further in upper New York State. They founded the city of Albany, which is today a very important city there. And they had a significant trading post up there, trading with the Indians. And you know that in this period of time, one of the most coveted commodities that Europeans bought from the Indians was furs, otters and beavers especially. And this, by the way, revolutionized Indian society when the Dutch and other European traders, French too, the French were very zealous traders. They followed the Indians all over into the hinterland of North America. buying furs and then shipping them out to the seaports and transporting them over to Europe. This revolutionized Indian society because the Indians expanded more zealously to stake out more trapping rights and so encroached on other people, other Indian tribes' lands. And what did they get for the furs? Well, first of all, they were satisfied to get beads and mirrors and small knives. But before long, they were buying guns from the Dutch. The Dutch were some of the very first to sell guns to them. And this revolutionized the relationship of the Indian tribes, by the way. And that's a whole other different story yet, into which we can't go tonight, looking at the Lutheran Church. Now, the English settlements, of course, these are eventually the most significant. And I want to pick out a few important ones. One of these is Virginia settlement. So if you are familiar with this geography here, in Virginia on the James River, where Jamestown is now, I don't even spot it on this map here, but that's where a stock company that was called the London Company was chartered by the English king with the assigned privileges or granted privileges. They could establish trade with the New World and staked out a whole section of territory which they could occupy and exploit. This company sent out these settlers that founded Jamestown. Actually, the company was chartered in 1606, and in a year or two, they had settlers out there, but, you know, they had a very rough time at first, and the date when actually that is given for the founding of Jamestown varies a little bit. Some books give it as late as 1620, but actually most of the books give about 1609. But there were people out there by 1607, but they could hardly manage to exist to keep themselves alive. Well, if the Indians hadn't been so friendly, you know the story of Pocahontas and others, you know, who were kind to them, those earliest English settlers there might have all died out. But they did manage to establish a company, and at first the corporate entity and the trade which they try to carry on, that was the important thing. And the colony would not flourish until the individual colonists saw that there's a lot of land to be had or simply to be bought from the Indians for song, practically. And one of the crops that they discovered in America was tobacco. And, you know, when they sent over some samples of tobacco, Europe was not plagued with this evil. You can tell I don't smoke. And when they sent over some samples of these leaves, everybody in Europe thought this was just tremendous, you know, this grass that they had over there in America. And all of a sudden, the tobacco growing industry just boomed, and the individuals in the colony of Jamestown undertook this enterprise to raise tobacco and sell it. And once they had surrendered to individual enterprise, then the prosperity of the colony really took off. Now, there may be a lesson here for individualism in economic theory or not, but at least that's how the history went there. And before very long, there was a very prosperous English colony going, which then grew into, later on it's always called Virginia. And Jamestown was only one of the settlements in it, but they had such a land tract, you know, that they settled many other places there. And this was Anglican, English Anglican. Anglican means the official Calvinist church that was recognized in England with the king or the monarch of England, as now we have a queen, and she is still the head of the Anglican Church. So England has always, from the time of the Reformation, had one official Protestant church. And this church dominated the religious activities of the whole colony. And lest we get any ideas that these people that left Europe and were willing to brave the dangers of sailing across the Atlantic Ocean and founding new homes in America believed in religious freedom, I want to read you from this law here, Articles, Laws, and Orders for the Colony of Virginia, 22nd of June, 1611. The governor proclaims, "I do strictly command and charge all captains and officers to have a care that the Almighty God be duly and daily served, and that they call upon their people to hear sermons, as that also they diligently frequent morning and evening prayer themselves by their own exemplar and daily life and duty herein, encouraging others thereunto, and that such who shall often and willfully absent themselves be duly punished according to the martial law in that case provided." So in other words, the law of the colony commanded, and he says daily, by the way, they had to go to church two times a day, morning and evening, for their group devotions. And these laws were amplified greatly. By the way, if you read all the statutes, they specified what the fines were if you missed too many services. And they had some pretty serious fines, but it was futile. They couldn't force the people to remain religious. And this religiosity slipped out of their grasp, by the way, before very long. But they made a heroic effort to force everyone to walk the straight and narrow. Now, another colony that was established by English charter was Maryland, which was chartered by the English king to Sir George Calvert. By the way, there's a typing error there. That's a T, not a Y. Who is usually called Lord Baltimore, and that's where the name of the city gets its name, and his son Cecil Calvert. And the religious conditions that were laid down in this charter were quite general. They are strikingly different from the religious laws of Virginia. They encourage a laudable and pious zeal for extending the Christian religion. Churches may be founded in accord with the ecclesiastical laws of England. No changes may be made by which God's holy name and the true Christian religion would suffer. Now, that seems very general, but the reason is that Lord Calvert was Catholic, and he knew that he didn't fit in well in the situation in England. Now, in the 1600s, we have a dynasty ruling in England called the Stuarts, four kings. And they were themselves not Roman Catholic, but they were very pro-Catholic. They had a great tolerance for high church ritual, for one thing, and an authoritarian system, and even for the Roman Catholic powers like France and Spain in Europe. And so this was a favor from a pro-Catholic king in England to a Catholic nobleman who wanted to get out of the country for his own comfort. And so sometimes we hear the Roman Catholics saying that the first Roman Catholic colony in all the Atlantic seaboard area that had religious toleration was Maryland. And that's not due to the fact that it was Roman Catholic. But there were so many other people of other religious convictions going over with Lord Baltimore that there was no choice in the matter. He simply had to make it that broad. Well, Maryland is a very interesting case study all by its own, and we can't go into very much detail here if we're going to study Lutherans. But turn over the page, and we have these famous Mayflower pilgrims who arrived in 1620 up here on the coast of Massachusetts. This map just barely shows it about there, where the city of Plymouth is today. By the way, have any of you had the opportunity to travel there? If you haven't, you ought to go there sometime. In Plymouth Harbor, there is a replica of the Mayflower. And for about a dollar, I guess it was, you can go on board and see what a miserable little boat that was on which those brave souls ventured to cross the Atlantic. You know that they were really determined to get away from Europe because they found no freedom for their religious convictions there in the European scene. You know, they had left England for Holland earlier under the first of these hard-nosed Stuart kings, James I. And then in Holland, they didn't feel comfortable, so when they had the opportunity, they wanted to go to the New World. And they had permission to land in the land tract of the London Company, which had settled in Virginia. But their navigation was poor, so they ended up far too far north, and they didn't know where they were. But they landed on Cape Cod, November 11th, 1620, and then came into the main part of the east coast there and settled down and formed a colony. Now, these Englishmen were separatists in this way. They were Puritans because they insisted they should really purify the ritual and doctrine of the Church of England much further than the English Reformation had done it. They were separatists because they thought the Church of England preserved much too much Roman Catholic doctrine and practice so that they couldn't stay in there. That's why they had to get out. They were convinced this was a compulsion for them to separate from the Church of England. Now, the next colony to be founded in Massachusetts, by the way, is Massachusetts Bay Colony. This was a charter company that was organized under the charter of an English king. And the amazing thing with this, you know, there were maybe X number of people who had participation in this company through the ownership of common stock. And all the stockholders decided to come over to the New World and to occupy the land which the royal charter had granted them. So this is an interesting economic and sociological phenomenon. These people were also English, and they were Puritans, but they were not separatists. There is some difference there. See, they had their own reservations about the kind of church structure with bishops and all that that they saw in the Church of England, but they did not make separation from that church their first objective. So that colony was founded in 1630, and Boston and then all the other settlements around Cambridge, you know, and then the famous settlements where they had the incidents of the Civil War later on, they grow out of this settlement. If you ever want to have, I would say don't go this year because half of the Americans are going to be tramping over all these bottle sites from Lexington to Concord and so on. But go maybe next year if they can put the pieces back together again. They anticipate in some of these historic areas, by the way, as many as 100,000 tourists a day in these summer months, you know, because of the bicentennial. But you ought to see those places sometime. Enormously interesting history. And the English drive that went in there is real interesting. Well, this became, of course, a very important colony, and then later on, together with Plymouth and other settlements, it was incorporated into Massachusetts and then became one of our states. Quakers in Pennsylvania, by the way, this is another very interesting settlement. William Penn, who was a Quaker and so a rebel against the Church of England, of course, also felt very uncomfortable in England, got a charter from the last of these four Stuart kings, Charles II, a little bit later than the other charters. And this one dates from the 1680s. And William Penn got a tremendous tract of land there, pretty ill-defined at that time. They didn't even know how massive North America was. But there was enough leeway that when they went over there and staked out the borders, this gradually grew into the state of Pennsylvania. And because William Penn and his Quaker friends believe that it was wrong to coerce people on religious matters, to say if you live in this country, you have to be a Roman Catholic, or if you're an Englishman, you have to belong to the Anglican Church. They thought this was nonsense. And so as soon as they had opened Pennsylvania with that charter granting them possession of that tract of land, there were soon many, many people of different kinds of somewhat radical or deviant religious persuasions flocking to Pennsylvania. And so this becomes the place in the New World where anybody was tolerated who didn't fit some other place. And by the way, this was a serious problem. In Virginia, for example, they had a law that every Quaker who intends to stay there will be penalized. In Massachusetts, they hung the Quakers. They hanged them. They executed them. Because, manifestly, these are very serious heretics. So this matter of toleration of religious views, separation of church and state, freedom of religious persuasion, you know, in our American tradition, that comes only later on. This was almost non-existent at that time, except for more toleration in Maryland and now in Pennsylvania. Now let's look at, Connecticut, I should say something about that. That's a different kind of situation. There's a Thomas Hooker there, who came up from Massachusetts, actually, and he wrote out a plan of government in 1639, and this was striking at that time because he left out these religious requirements for citizens. So that's a new venture in Connecticut that early, by the way. Well, there are other colonies we might look at, but these are some of the interesting religious phenomena that we have there, but I have to hurry on. Look at capital B, rearrangements of land claims and colonies in early American history. Now, I'm not going to go through all these wars that the European nations fought, but here is what happened. So you have Spain in the south, by the way, and when they saw that the other nations were starting to fill in the middle areas of North America, they pushed north much more zealously, by the way, and then occupied California, Arizona, Mexico, and parts of Texas, and the French up there, and the English in the middle, and the English were fighting both, Spain and France, almost chronically. So in the 18th century, the English drive the Spaniards out of Florida. That's one significant change, by the way. And they fought the French up here all through what is now Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, and so on, even down to, you know, the story of Pittsburgh here, where the French had a fort at one time, and pushed them northward. And so by 1763 is a turning point, by the way. That is the Treaty of Paris, when the English put the really decisive defeat to French aspirations. Also drove them out of India, by the way, that year in Asia. So that is an important turning point. And Louisiana Territory, then, which was French, was surrendered to Spain as a sort of a compensation. Later on, in Napoleon's time, you know, he took that from the Spanish again and sold it to America in 1803. And Canada was lost by the French. They surrendered that to England. Oh, one important point. I didn't look at Arabic I at all here. The English conquest of the Dutch and Swedish holdings, New Amsterdam and New Sweden, that became New York in 1664. That's almost 100 years before what I have in Arabic too. So the Dutch and the Swedes are eliminated in what is today Delaware, Pennsylvania, and New York. Okay, let's go on to Roman II, churches in colonial America. Now, I wove some of this in already, so I can just reiterate a few of the important ones here. Anglicans, I said, were ensconced in Virginia. That was very strongly official church of England. and down to the American Revolution. You know, that's the predominant church body there. After the American Revolution, of course, they couldn't call it Anglican anymore, so they changed the name in America to Episcopalian. Because obviously that church, American Episcopalians, could no longer subscribe to being under the authority of the King of England as the head of the church. See, it didn't work. So politics got in the way of their religious affiliation there. So the name was changed. But this is one major religious affiliation. And by the way, many, many of the signers of the American Declaration of Independence, they were Virginians. Washington himself, George Washington, was a Virginian. Thomas Jefferson and many others, prominent people, came from this state, and they were out of this tradition. Then there were the separatists in Plymouth. I mentioned them before. And the Congregationalist tradition, by the way, which later on is recognized as a denomination, grows out of Massachusetts. And then there were these Puritans in Boston who were not so separatist, but they were also very determined that their own tradition was the correct one, and Congregationalist tradition grows out of them. Then where the Presbyterians come from, that is, has a scattered background. Presbyterians also originated in England in the 17th century, and people came over to various parts in the American colonies. Some settled on Long Island as early as the 1640s. And by the 1680s and 90s, Scotch-Irish founded Presbyterian churches in Maryland and Virginia. By 1706, the first presbytery is organized. That's sort of like a synod among Lutherans. So the Presbyterians were scattered throughout the Atlantic seaboard, and they had for a long time a sort of a middle ground between Anglicans and the separatists, the Presbyterians did. And so there is not so much persecution of these people, because they were sort of middle ground between these two more radical persuasions. And then, of course, the Quakers in Pennsylvania. And one thing about Pennsylvania, that is the tremendous diversity that began to develop there. Capital B, Roman Catholics, they were definitely only a minority on the Atlantic seaboard. And the best statistics indicate that there were probably only a small percentage, I don't mean 15 or 20, but very small percentage of Roman Catholics scattered throughout Maryland and a couple of other of the colonies at the time of the American Revolution. So it was definitely an English Protestant domination in the churches there. Now there were some Lutherans, and we want to look at this too, but I want to emphasize that we should keep the perspective clear that the Lutheran churches in the colonial period did not have a very large input into the American religious situation. So one of the factors, by the way, is this, I'm on capital C, Arabic 1 now, this tremendous religious diversity among Lutheran immigrants in the colonial period. There were people from all places in Germany that were pried loose because they didn't fit, or there was persecution, or there was famine, and usually the first ones to leave were those that fit the most uncomfortably in their own homeland. And so the radical Christians came first, and they found the most ready refuge in Pennsylvania. We'll take our break here, and there will be refreshments upstairs, I guess. And please use this stairway here. Go up. We divide the various groups. You see that there isn't too much congestion in the hallway. And this one I have entitled Lutheran and Other Churches in the Young American Republic. So we're moving down in time past the year of the American Revolution, or the years of the American Revolution. And I feel that it is not a good perspective if we look only at the Lutherans. You know, when you study anything at all, like this wall, you don't want to look only at the space that is covered by this picture. You want to first see the whole thing in perspective. And I feel that in the study of the Lutheran Church in American history, it is important to see the other churches also emerging in the context of which the Lutherans had to exist and somehow work out their mission as best as they could. If we don't do it that way, in the full perspective, we lose some of the significant history of that period. And that's the reason I call this Lutheran and other churches in the young American Republic. Now, Roman I, the background of Protestant theology in colonial America, the theological orientation is very important because so much of the thought structure and the ideology of the American Revolution grows out of that. And I would dare say that Lutherans, as I will point out afterwards, there was a prominent Lutheran pastor in colonial America who had grave reservations about this kind of an intellectual atmosphere in which he had to live and work. So I begin, capital A, the theology of the American Revolution. So if I can call this theology, but in quotation marks, the whole idea system, whatever theology and whatever secular thought goes into that, but at least this is what I have in mind. And Arabic I, the earlier Puritan and Anglican religious stance, of course, is Calvinistic all the way through. And Calvinism, by the way, at that time, when it was in its prime, is a very demanding kind of Protestantism. This was not a flaccid kind, a permissive kind of theology. They had very firm ideas. Like I mentioned, all the English colonies, Virginia and Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay, were all Calvinists in theology. They had different ideas about the nature of church organization, but in theology, they were Calvinist. And one of the main points, by the way, of Calvinist theology that I highlight here under small a is the distinct view on church-state relations that Calvinists had at that time universally throughout the world. Now, if you look at Lutheran theology, we say that the identifying marks of the church are this, the preaching of the Word of God, and the correct administration of the sacraments. And you look at our Augsburg Confession, it's spelled out there in such simple terms. Two marks of the church, preaching of the word and the administration of the sacraments. Now the Calvinists add to that a third point, and that is church discipline. Now, Lutherans are not averse to church discipline. We have that built in with the idea of the preaching of the word, because that means both law and gospel. And when a sinner gets out of line and is not repentant, then the application of the law is church discipline. So Lutherans didn't omit that. But the fact that Calvinists pulled it out from the concept of the application of the word, both law and gospel, and put it up there in the third place, indicates that they had a very serious preoccupation with that. And if people got out of line, who would exert the final authority in disciplining them and bringing them back, or in punishing them? That was, according to Calvinist theology, the responsibility of the state. And on that point, by the way, in respect to church discipline, Calvinist theology differed radically from Lutheran theology. in Lutheran churches in Europe, even where you had a state church, like in Germany, almost all the nations of Europe that were Lutheran had state churches at that time, you did not have that strong affirmation of the imperative of disciplining recalcitrant sinners that the state was alleged to have, like you have it under Calvinists. So in certain situations, in Europe already, I'm not talking about America now, but in Europe already, Calvinists bluntly stated that if a person is a blasphemer or a notorious heretic, the state has the duty even to put him to death so that he doesn't infect other Christians with his heretical ideas. This is the principle, by the way, in which in England nonconformists were driven out and they were punished. And this is the principle under which in Massachusetts in the 1600s, witches were burnt, Quakers were hung, and so on. You see, their notion that it is the responsibility of the civil authority to enforce the religious precepts of their society. On this point, they differed from the Lutherans very, very strenuously. And by the way, when you look at this thing in later American history, I was just talking to somebody here, one of my colleagues, or was it a group of students, I guess, some months ago on this point. You know, gradually in America, they gave up this notion. And all the states also wrote into their constitutions the separation clause that is in our federal constitution. Congress shall make no laws concerning an establishment of religion. Something similar went into all the state constitutions. But you know that Presbyterians, especially of all the Calvinist churches, maintained this notion that the two, state, church and state, are pretty closely tied together. And so as I was thinking about this, you see in different statesmen in modern American history, this peculiar combination come out on the surface. John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, had ideas that as a statesman, it was his God-given responsibility to enforce the scriptural principles in political ethics and international relations that are prescribed in the scriptures. Woodrow Wilson, president in the period of the First World War, also a Presbyterian, with very similar notions. So you see it even in modern times, by the way. This is a major point of difference, and the reason I put some emphasis on this is because Calvinism, with its concept of the union of church and state, is what gave shape to some of our earliest colonies. And it was in that situation, by the way, that it was very difficult, if not impossible, for Lutherans even to exist, because they were nonconformists according to the Calvinist definition. And so it's not strange that you don't find any Lutherans in the strongly Calvinist colonies until they abandoned this notion that the state should coerce people to conform to the Calvinist type of theology. Also, Calvinist doctrine on predestination is a salient difference with Lutheranism, but that doesn't figure into the picture quite as strongly on the American scene. But, you know, just to explain it briefly, though, you know that the scripture teaches that God, from all eternity, selected some people to be called by his word and to be converted by the Holy Spirit, to come to faith in Christ and also to be saved. If this is true, the human mind wants to speculate, why didn't God predestine all people to salvation. Bingo, and our mind wants to penetrate that puzzle, and we can't. The Bible doesn't tell us, and so we assume this side of the coin says, those who are saved are predestined. Then we say the reverse must be the opposite. Those who are lost were predestined by God to damnation. This is the way Calvinist theology actually rationalized this. And so they hold a double predestination. That didn't have all that much to do with the American church scene, though, as far as Lutheran churches are concerned. Another distinctive feature, by the way, is the austerity of life. In the early colonies, you know how they emphasized hard work and frugality. And social historians, by the way, believe that this was one of the basic ingredients that made for the growth of capitalism in the English-speaking countries. You know, the emphasis on hard work, laziness was one of the worst sins to a Calvinist. And then frugality, you don't dare waste the goods that God has given you through your hard work. You should save them. And then, of course, enterprise or entrepreneurship, you know, the investment of those resources and making them work for you. The Calvinists had a bent for this. So our New England merchants, by the way, all Calvinists or of Calvinist tradition, many of them had departed considerably by the 18th century from that tradition, but that's their ultimate background, and they were superb seafarers and commercial artists trading all over the world, developing trade even with China. So this austerity in life and the bent for economic enterprise, that is strong in them, stronger than among Lutherans, by and large, I dare say. And then we go down to Arabic 2, the secularization of religion in America. What I mean by this is that this old line of stringent and strict Calvinist doctrine and church discipline couldn't hold the line. What happened in both England and America was a gradual moving away from these heavenly objectives down to this world, and that is the process we call secularization. And that happened also in America. Gradually, people fell away from the church, actually. They simply turned their back on their religious heritage and became pretty much unbelievers. Now, it's not in history, when you look at this movement, it's not that all of a sudden in 1 year, a lot of people, say take 1,000 people here in this town and 1,500 in that town, decide to sever their relations with the church completely. It doesn't happen that way. It doesn't happen that way in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in 1974, 1975, and 76 either. You give it up gradually. You first question this doctrine, and then that doctrine, and finally you have a sort of a diluted Christianity left, in quotation marks, which at that time, even today, is called Unitarianism. And that was the mod thing in early America as people departed from this stricter Bible-based Calvinism and began to liberalize this. One of the key doctrines, by the way, which they questioned earliest was the doctrine of the Trinity. And the reason they questioned this was because they figured this doesn't make sense according to our human reason. And therefore, they abandoned that doctrine, and for that reason, they are labeled as Unitarians. So they reject the deity of Christ. They claim that we're not atheists, we believe in God, but in a unified God, and from that the name Unitarianism arises. Now, in America, by the way, towards the end of the 1600s, this was a very noticeable movement away from the churches and towards Unitarianism. And it's striking, by the way, that in Boston and other places in Massachusetts, some of the most aggressive and important Unitarian churches came precisely from these Puritan churches. Some of them just turned, they became affiliated with this new movement and severed their connections with the Trinitarian Calvinist organizations. They simply turned course. The same church one year was Calvinist, Trinitarian, the next year it identified itself with Unitarianism. So, in other words, if we look at it as in the measure of statistics, how many Christians were there in colonial America, you can graph it, you know, the line goes downwards. There were less and less people in colonial America who identified themselves as Christians. Less and less. And that continues pretty well towards the time of the Reformation, with one upsurge, I would say. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Would the Calvinists and Unitarians be considered Christians?
From our standpoint, the Unitarians would not be considered Christians. The Calvinists, yes, we would consider them Christian. Mm-hmm. According to the basic doctrines, they believe in a triune God, they believe in the deity of Christ, in the virgin birth and the resurrection of Christ, and the vicarious atonement, and the second coming of Christ. They believed in all that. Now, we have some differences with the old line Calvinist on predestination, on the proper separation of church and state, and certainly also on the Lord's Supper, and also on the whole function and the efficacy of the sacraments. So some of the Calvinists, you see, they especially emphasize this bit that the sacraments do not have efficacy. That is, they don't really work forgiveness of sins. They're a symbol, and then you get the Baptist denomination grows out of that. So if that's true, that the sacraments do not really work forgiveness of sins as we confess, then why baptize infants? You see? So those emphases, which are definitely false doctrine, we would say, if we were real forthright, compared to the Scripture, they are certainly departures from Scripture, but they do not negate the Christianity. But Unitarianism does, because they do not recognize Christ as true God. So there's a difference there. Now, by the way, this whole trend, Arabic 3, this is called deism. And here I would like to call your attention to two English words. This one here, of course, and the word theism, which resemble each other. The first one comes from the Latin word for God. The second one comes from the Greek word for God. So it has something to do with belief in God. Now, the two words now have been applied in English to such different ideas that we have to be sure that we distinguish them. Theism is simply the belief that there is a supreme being. Now, what kind, we don't say. Mohammedanism would be a theistic religion because they believe in Allah, who is said to be transcendent above human beings. The Indians believed in the Great Spirit, and that would be theism. And the negative, of course, is atheism, right? That word we know better from common usage. And deism, though, is that notion that we don't really know, or it doesn't make much difference, or there may be a supreme being. There may be. See, not the denial of it, But the, well, skeptical attitude towards it, that's built in there. So there may be a supreme being who probably created the world back there sometime, someplace, and then let it run by itself. That's the basic notion of God that the deists developed. And somehow this name became attached to that whole movement, and that's called deism also in America. Now, one of the most famous thinkers is an Englishman by the name of John Locke, who lived the years 1632 to 1704. And you see, this is the period of time when these first colonies were really taking root in America. And John Locke was a famous writer and scholar in England, wrote some books which made a tremendous impact on the thinking of people, also on the American colonials, by the way. One of the books which he wrote is usually called Essays on Civil Government. There were two of them, two different essays which he wrote at different times, but they're usually published together. And then I'll go into some of the details here before long. Then he also did a letter concerning toleration, which he wrote in 1667 and was then published later. Now, some of the notions that he propounded here, I give you some quotations so that you don't have to write any notes and don't have to try to memorize it, but you can take it home, put it in your file. He says in paragraph 119 in these treatises on civil government that every man, being, as has been shown, naturally free, and nothing being able to put him into subjection to any earthly power but his own consent, it is to be considered what shall be understood to be the sufficient declaration of a man's consent to make him subject to the laws of any government. Now, maybe I should have given you a little bit more of the background here. What John Locke, like so many Englishmen at that time, were interested in is answering the question, what is the origin of government? You know, the Englishmen had a big revolution. In fact, right during this time, I said the 1600s is the time of the four Stuart kings. They're easy to remember, by the way, but they follow the first Elizabeth. She died 1603. Then come four Stuart kings. James the First is first. Charles the First is second. And then comes the interlude of the English Revolution, when they chopped poor Charles's head off, and Oliver Cromwell comes in. If you remember high school English history, that all comes back a little bit, doesn't it? Then when Cromwell died, the Englishmen decided we can't manage without a king. What are we going to do? So they asked Charles's son, who had wisely gone to France, please come back, we'll make you king. And so in 1660, they had a wonderful celebration called the Restoration. And no sooner had they had him there than they were sorry that they called him back, because he just doesn't fit, see? But his, that was his brother, I guess, James the Second then. So these four kings, two Jameses and two Charleses. And by that time, the Englishmen had had it again by the end of the 1680s. And James the Second saw the handwriting on the wall, and he packed up his suitcase and beat it one night before they captured him and put him to death, like his poor daddy. So he left for France before he was pushed out, and then they had the Glorious Revolution. And during all this period of time, you see, the serious-minded Englishmen were trying to answer this question, what is the origin of government? Are people justified in deposing a king? Killing a king? And this is why they wrote treatises on government. And what the theory that John Locke developed is what is called the contract theory of government. He speculated that in ancient times there were no governments. When people lived scattered out, this is of course a presumption on his part. He never bothered to prove it. But he only said, that's the way I think it was. And then people found that they can't live together efficiently and effectively and still preserve their possessions and property if there is no compact. You don't steal my property if I don't steal yours. You don't kill me if I don't kill you, and so on. You leave my family alone, I'll leave yours alone. And all these conventions, you know, of law-abiding society. He said people just agreed to observe these rules. This is the compact theory of government. So then, he says that people are free, but we give our consent to be governed and ruled by certain laws and by certain people. And this is very anti-royalty, of course. It pulls the rug out from underneath kings who insist that God gave them the right to rule and eliminates this kind of notion of government. Now, this kind of notion of the freedom of men, natural rights, and so on, he also spelled out, by the way, and if you look further down the next paragraph, in the state of nature, there has a law of nature to govern it, he says, which obliges everyone. That is, it has authority over everyone. And reason, which is that law, teaches all mankind who will but consult it that being all equal and independent, no one ought to harm another in his life, health, liberty, or possession. That's how he develops it. So in other words, there is a natural law that creator, we don't know where he is now, but he built that into the very nature of the world he made, that we all have this right for the pursuit of life, health, liberty, and possessions. Natural law is the key word here, by the way. And so in America, they read John Locke very zealously, by the way. They didn't have a morning edition of the paper. They didn't have a TV program or a radio program or a telephone, but they heard about it very soon, and they read his books, by the way. And so when these gentlemen sat down to write the Declaration of Independence, what did they put down? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And this is basically what I mean by, quote, theology of the American Revolution. It was English deism all the way through. Yes?
The early fathers of the country, however, weren't really deists, were they?
Early fathers of the country, you take Thomas Jefferson.
Washington, Jefferson, Franklin.
Washington himself was, I do not think, a Trinitarian Christian. Thomas Jefferson was very definitely not a Trinitarian Christian. We could not call Franklin a Christian by any stretch of the imagination.
But the fact that they did what they did in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, they must have had some feeling of a religious background or
yeah, that's right.
God.
They were not atheists. You see, make that distinction now. That's why I explained the difference between these two words. They were not atheists, but they were not Trinitarian Christians. Jefferson was very much outspoken there. He did quite a bit of writing, too, in these areas. He was very definitely a deist who held, though, to natural law. This is the difference. And under natural law, by the way, besides defending the rights of people to a decent life and to freedom in keeping their earnings and so on, also had moral values inculcated in that, by the way. Now, here is the difference By the way, this is a vast, tremendous change that has occurred in American legal concepts. That at that time, they held that human beings are rational creatures, which they were. These fellows were Washington, Jefferson, Franklin. They were eminently rational and reasonable people. Today we have come away from that. We are really today living in an irrational age where people decide most questions by the impulse of their subjective emotions. And still we want to make our big national decisions by the principles that governed us 200 and more years ago. So it doesn't fit, you see. In other words, if you build yourself a shelter to ward off the cold, and it is 30 degrees out, you need only yay much protection. Gradually the temperature drops to 50 below, and you don't take that into account that the atmosphere has changed. You want to get by with the same amount of shelter, you can't do it. That's what's happened to America, by the way. They have lost the concept of rational and moral people, even if they were not Trinitarian Christians. So that's a big change, I think. But I think it's important to keep in mind, by the way, I hear this once in a while in this bicentennial year, that our country was founded on a sound Christian foundation. Nonsense! It was deist, which was not Christian. It had a Christian derivation, was based on natural law, which included basic humanitarian principles, including morality, humanitarian morality, but not scriptural morality. There was quite a gap between, but it was still much better than what we have today. Well, let's move down. To all this rationalism, then, which became more and more separated from whatever connections it had had with God's Word. That is, it turned further and further to the left. By the early 1700s, there were so few people, members of churches, that churchmen saw a tremendous need here. And some of these preachers that I have listed, they undertook a great revival, which is called the Great Awakening. And under Arabic too, I have some of the great Englishmen listed there who also worked in America. But in one, there is a Dutch Reformed pastor listed who is usually omitted. But this Theodor J. Frelinghuysen, in his own preaching as early as 1726, somehow had a gift. He could hammer away at people and persuade them that they were utter condemned sinners that might just as well be crushed right here and now by the weight of God's judgment. And these people that heard him, they would go through agonizing convulsions, calling out in desperate confession of their sins. And they would roll on the floor and things like this, and then have a conversion experience. And this type of emotional religious experience of contrition and then new birth is what we mean by this great awakening. And one of the most powerful of these preachers was George Whitefield, who was an Englishman who came to America to and the Wesley brothers too, Charles and John Wesley, by the way, they lived in the 1700s. They came to America as missionaries first. And by the way, it's interesting that John Wesley was on the same ship on which a load of Moravians came. And the Moravians were very deeply rooted Christians. Here on this little sailing vessel on the Atlantic, they went through an enormous storm. They thought the ship would certainly sink. And Moravians, by and large, they had such a profound faith in God. They were really admirable Christians in many ways. You have to say that. They sat calmly by the mast, holding on so they wouldn't fall off. And Wesley was scared to death. And he asked himself, what do those Germans have that I haven't got? And when they got to America afterwards, God saw them safely through. They weren't shipwrecked. And then he began to ask the Moravians, and one of the leaders, the pastor of that group, was a man by the name of Spangenberg. He became a bishop afterwards, was one of their great leaders. And he told them, you simply have to trust totally in God. He said, totally. And this was even a new experience for Wesley. And he pursued this to get a deeper insight into this, and then he shared that in his preaching, and he could simply flatten people with the preaching of the law, really score them, so they felt this cut of contrition through the very quick of their natures, and bring them to repentance and faith in Christ like this. And pretty soon, this movement of Great Awakening, these revival meetings, spread all through the colonies. And there was a tremendous upsurge of church-going faith and so on. Francis Asbury became the famous Methodist leader. And Timothy Dwight, by the way, famous educator in the American colonies, he became one of the outstanding pioneers of this also, with the students and so on. So all through America, this America was then confined to the eastern seaboard, of course, but this swept through there in the early decades of the 18th century. And one of the offshoots of this is interesting, though, that increased the number of denominations, which you find, although there was also at the same time an enormous church growth. One of the interesting things here is that this Gilbert Tennant, Danger of an Unconverted Ministry in 1740, this was published. This was an attack, a criticism of, quote, unbelieving pastors who were shepherds of Christian churches. And he scored their unbelief and tried to awaken them to a deeper religiosity. And so in this preaching that Tennant engaged in, there was quite a stir, quite an upheaval that ran through the Presbyterian churches and actually caused a cleavage, a split. They split into two parts. One that was in favor of this revival preaching and one that was opposed to it. And later on, in 18 years, that's a short time, in 18 years they rejoined. And when you look at the statistics, the group that had opposed the revival preaching, and I'm not a revivalist, believe you me. I just quote the history now. I'm very suspicious of this kind of movement. But the group that opposed the revivals, they had a constant membership. They stayed the same. The other group had grown fivefold. Fivefold. So when we say that the revivals brought more people into the church, that's a historical fact with which we have to cope. Well, I mentioned Barton W. Stone. He was a prominent Presbyterian active in Kentucky. And when he began to be active in this revival preaching, he turned his back on one of the basic tenets of Calvinist theology. And so there was another denomination which arose. So the two points I try to make here by giving certain small examples is the increase in denominationalism, but the increase in church growth also. That is something that gave new shape to Protestant churches on the American frontier that could not be undone again. Now, if you turn the page over, Roman II, Lutherans among the churches in the Young Republic. Wow, I have lost my time somehow. Much of this is only summarization. You see, I talked about the Lutherans in early New York already. I just want to summarize here in this first part. Joshua Kochertal was one of the Lutheran pastors who brought a group of Lutherans from southwestern Germany called the Palatinate to the Hudson Valley, and in the 1730s and 40s, this becomes an increasing flow of immigrants. And then I mentioned the Lutherans in Pennsylvania. D, the Salzburgers in Georgia, I hadn't said anything about that. That was an organized immigration of Lutherans from the city of Salzburg, which is now in Austria, where they were persecuted by their Catholic archbishop and the Catholic king, and they came to Georgia. So there was an increasing flow of Lutherans. That's the point I'm trying to make. And Lutherans didn't always have it that easy. If you look down to Roman Arabic 2b, when there was an increasing flow of Lutherans, here is what Benjamin Franklin had to say. Why should the Palatine boors be suffered to swarm into our settlements and by herding together establish their language and manners to the exclusion of ours? Why should Pennsylvania, founded by the English, become a colony of aliens who will shortly be so numerous as to Germanize us instead of our Anglifying them? Okay, that's how a man as tolerant as old Ben Franklin thought about these Germans who were flooding into the colonies. Now, Arabic 3, Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, I already mentioned him before, and he was a longtime pastor who tried to organize these scattered Lutherans into congregations and shepherd them by preaching the Word of God to them and teaching their children. And when the American Revolution took place, Muhlenberg was in a predicament. And this is what he wrote in his diary, July 4th, 1776. Today, the Continental Congress openly declared the United Provinces of North America to be free and independent states. This has caused some thoughtful and far-seeing melancholy people to, he likes to use those Latin words, to be down in the mouth. On the other hand, it has caused some sanguine myopes, he calls these short-sighted sanguine people, to exult and shout with joy. In fine videbitur, cuius toni, that's a Latin expression that means in the end, we will see who has given the pitch. Muhlenberg found it difficult to rebel against constituted authority. And he was no deist, and he could not go along with this notion that if you don't like the government under which you live, you can overthrow it by force. Couldn't go along with that. And so Lutherans had a real difficult predicament at the time of the American Revolution. Second generation had an easier time adapting to the challenge of American revolutionary ideas than the first generation had. I think in the Muhlenberg family, you can especially see this. Well, I tell you, I'm going to take up capital B again in lecture 3 anyway, so I don't even have to look at that now. And we're already 4 minutes over. So we'll see you all back here, God willing, next Thursday, right?